Repetitiously, the unifying theme to the stories in this collection is pain, human anguish. But there is a subtext that informs the subject. It is this: we are all inescapably responsible not only for our own actions, but for our lack of action, the morality and ethic of our silences and our avoidances, the shared guilt of hypocrisy, voyeurism, and cowardice, what might be called the spectator sport social conscience. Catherine Genovese, Martin Luther King, Viola Liuzzo, Nathaniel West, Marilyn Monroe. How the hell do we face them if there's something like a hereafter? And how do we make it day to day, what with mirrors everywhere we look, if there isn't a hereafter? Perhaps it all comes down to the answer to the question any middle-aged German in, say, Munich might ask today: if I didn't do what they said, they'd kill me. I had to save my life, didn't I? I'm sure when it comes right down to it, the most ignominious life is better than no life at all. But again and again, I find the answer coming from somewhere too noble to be within myself. What for? Staying alive only has merit if one does it with dignity, with purpose, with responsibility to his fellow man. If these are absent, then living is like a slug-like thing, more a matter of habit than worth. Without courage, the pain will destroy you. And, oh yeah, about this story, the last section came first. It was a tone poem written to a little folk song Tom Scott wrote titled 38th Parallel, which Rusty Draper recorded vocally some years later as Lonesome Song. If you can find a 45 RPM of it anywhere and play it as you read the final sections, it will vastly enhance audibly coloring an explanation of what I mean when I talk about pain that is deeper than the darkness. They came to Alf Gunderson in the Pawnee County Jail. He was sitting, hugging his bony knees against the plasteel wall of the cell. On the plasteel floor lay an ancient three-string mandolin he had borrowed from the deputy. He had been plunking, with some talent, all that hot summer day. Under his thin buttocks, the empty trough of his mattressless bunk curved beneath his weight. He was an extremely tall man, even hunched up that way. He was more than tired-looking, more than weary. His was an inside weariness. He was a gaunt, empty-looking man. His hair fell lanky and drab and gray-brown in shocks over a low forehead. His eyes seemed to be peas, withdrawn from their pods and placed in a starkly white face. It was difficult to tell whether he could see from them. Their blankness only accented the total cipher he seemed. There was no inch of expression or recognition on his face, in the line of his body. More, he was a thin man. He seemed to be a man who had given up the search long ago. His face didn't change its hollow stare at the plasteel barred door opposite, even as it swung back to admit the two non-entities. The two men entered, their stride as alike as the unobtrusive gray mesh suits they wore, as alike as the faces that would fade from memory moments after they had turned. The turnkey, a grizzled country deputy with a -8 rating, stared after the men with open wonder on his bearded face. One of the gray-suited men turned, pinning the wondering stare to the deputy's face. His voice was calm and unrippled. "Close the door and go back to your desk." The words were cold and paced. They brooked no opposition. It was obvious. They were mindees. The roar of a late afternoon inverse space ship split the waiting moment outside. Then the turnkey slammed the door, palming it Loctite. He walked back out of the cell block, hands deep in his coverall pockets. His head was lowered as though he were trying to solve a complex problem. It, too, was obvious. He was trying to block his thoughts off from those goddamned mindies. When he was gone, the telepaths circled Gunderson slowly, their faces softly altered, subtly, and personality flowed in with quickness. They shot each other confused glances. Him? The first man thought, nodding slightly at the still, knee-hugging prisoner. That's what the report said, Ralph. The other man removed his forehead-concealing snap brim and sat down on the edge of the bunk trough. He touched Gunderson's leg with tentative fingers. He's not thinking, for God's sake, the thought flashed. I can't get a thing. Incredulity sparkled in the thought. He must be blocked off by trauma barrier, came the reply from the telepath named Ralph. Is your name Alf Gunderson? The first mindy inquired softly, a hand on Gunderson's shoulder. The expression never changed. The head swiveled slowly, and the dead eyes came to bear on the dark-suited telepath. I'm Gunderson, he replied briefly. His tones indicated no enthusiasm, no curiosity. The first man looked up at his partner, doubt wrinkling his eyes, pursing his lips. He shrugged his shoulders as if to say, who knows? He turned back to Gunderson, immobile as before, hewn from rock. Silent as the pit. What are you in here for, Gunderson? He spoke as though he were unused to words, the halting speech of the telepath. The dead stare swung back to the plasteel bars. I set the woods on fire, he said shortly. The mindee's face darkened at the prisoner's words. That was what the report had said, the report that had come in from one of the remote corners of the country. The American continent was a modern thing, all plasteel and printed circuits, all relays and fast movement, but there had been areas of backwoods country that had never taken to civilizing. They still maintained roads and jails and fishing holes and forests. Out of one of these had come three reports, spaced an hour apart, with startling ramifications, if true. They had been snapped through the primary message banks in Capital City and Buenos Aires, reeled through the computerizers, and handed to the Bureau for check-in. While the inverse space ships plied between worlds, while Earth fought its transgalactic wars, in a rural section of the American continent, a strange thing was happening. A mile and a half of raging forest fire. And Alf Gunderson, the one responsible. So they had sent two Bureau mindies. How did it start, Alf? The dead eyes closed momentarily in pain, opened, and he answered, I was trying to get the pot to heat up, trying to set the kindling under it to burning. I fired myself too hard. A flash of self-pity and unbearable hurt came into his face, disappeared just as quickly. Empty once more, he added, I always do. The first man exhaled sharply, got up and put on his hat. The personality flowed out of his face. He was a carbon copy of the other telepath once more. This is the one, he said. Come on, Alf, the mindy named Ralph said. Let's go. The authority of his voice no more served to move Gunderson than their initial appearance had. He sat as he was. The two men looked at one another. What's the matter with him? The second one flashed. If you had what he's got, you'd be a bit buggy yourself, the first one replied. They were no longer individuals, they were Bureau men, studiedly, exactly, precisely alike in every detail. They hoisted the prisoner under his arms, lifted him off the bunk, unresisting. The turnkey came at a call and, still marveling at these men who had come in, shown Bureau cards, sworn him to deadly silence, and were now taking the tramp firebug with them, opened the cell door. As they passed before him, the telepath named Ralph turned suddenly sharp and piercing eyes on the old guard. "This is government business, mister," he warned. "One word of this, and you'll be a prisoner in your own jail. Clear?" The turnkey bobbed his head quickly. "And stop thinking, mister," the mindee added nastily. "We don't like to be referred to as slimy peekers." The turnkey turned a shade paler and watched silently as they disappeared down the hall, out of the Pawnee County Jailhouse. He waited, blanking fiercely till he heard the whine of the Bureau solo cab rising in the afternoon sky. Now what the devil did they want with a crazy firebug hobo like that? He thought viciously. Goddamn mindies. After they had flown him cross-continent to Buenos Aires, deep in the heart of the blasted Argentine desert, they sent him in for testing. The testing was exhaustive. Even though he didn't really cooperate, there were things he could not keep them from learning, things that showed up because they were there, such as his ability to start fires with his mind, such as the fact that he could not control the blazes, such as the fact that he had been bumming for 15 years in an effort to find seclusion, such as the fact that he had become a tortured, an unhappy man because of his strange mind power. "Alf," said the bodiless voice from the rear of the darkened auditorium, "light that cigarette on the table. Put it in your mouth and make it light, Alf, without a match." Alf Gunderson stood in the circle of light. He shifted from leg to leg on the blazing stage and eyed the cylinder of white paper on the table. It was starting again. The harrying, the testing, the staring with strangeness. He was different, even from the other accredited psioid types. And they would try to put him away. It had happened before, it was happening now. There was no real peace for him. "I don't smoke," he said, which was not true. But this was brother kin to the uncountable police lineups he had gone through all the way across the American continent, across Earth, and from A Centauri 9 back here. It annoyed him, and it terrified him, for he knew he was trapped. Except this time there was no tough, rock-faced cops out there in the darkness beyond his sight. This time there were tough, rock-faced Bureau men and Spacecom officials. Even Terrence, head of Spacecom, was sitting in one of those pneumo seats, watching him steadily, daring him to be what he was. He lifted the cylinder hesitantly, almost put it back. "Smoke it, Alf," snapped a different voice, deeper in tone from the ebony before him. He put the cigarette between his lips. They waited. He seemed to want to say something, perhaps to object. Alf Gunderson's heavy brows drew down. His blank eyes became, if it were possible, even blanker. A sharp, denting V appeared between the brows. The cigarette flamed to life. A tongue of fire leaped up from the tip. In an instant, it had consumed tobacco, paper, filter, and denicotizer in one roar. The fire slammed against Gunderson's lips, searing them, lapping at his nose, his face. He screamed, fell on his face, and beat at the flames with his hands. Suddenly, the stage was clogged with running men in the blue and charcoal suits of the Spacecom. Gunderson lay writhing on the floor, a wisp of charry smoke rising from his face. One of the Spacecom officials broke the cap on an extinguisher vial, and the spray washed over the body of the fallen man. "Get the Malaport! Get the goddamned Malaport, will ya?" A young ensign, with brush-cut blonde hair, first to reach the stage, as though he had been waiting crouched below, cradled Gunderson's head in his muscular arms, brushing with horror at the flakes of charred skin. He had the watery blue eyes of the spacemen, those who had seen terrible things, yet his eyes were more frightened now than any man's eyes were meant to be. In a few minutes, the angular, spade-pawed, malleable transporter was smoothing the skin on Gunderson's face, realigning the atoms, shearing away the burned flesh, coating it with vibrant, healthy, pink skin. Another few moments, and the cyoid was finished. The burns had been erased. Gunderson was new and whole, save for the patches of healthier-seeming skin that dotted his face. All through it, he had been murmuring. As the Malaport finished his mental work, stood up with a sigh, the words filtered through to the young spacecom ensign. He stared at Gunderson a moment, then raised his watery blue eyes to the other officials standing about. He stared at them with a mixture of fear and bewilderment. Gunderson had been saying, "Let me die, please let me die. I want to die. Won't you let me die, please?" The ship was heading toward Omalo, son of the Delgarte system. It had been translated into Inverspace by a driver named Karina Correa. She had warped the ship through and gone back to her deep sleep till she was needed at Omalo Snapout. Now, the ship whirled through the crazy quilt of Inverspace, cutting through to the star system of Earth's adversary. Gunderson sat in the cabin with the brush-cut blonde ensign. All through the trip, since blastoff and snapout, the pyrotic had been kept in his stateroom. This was the newest of the Earth spacecom ships, yet he had seen none of it, just this tiny stateroom in the constant company of the usually stoical ensign. The spacecom man's watery blue eyes swept between the pallid man and the teleport-proof safe set in the cabin's bulkhead. "Any idea why they're sending us so deep into Delgarte territory?" the ensign fished. "It's pretty tight lines up this far. Must be something big. Any idea?" Gunderson's eyes came up from their focus on his boot tops and stared at the spaceman. He idly flipped the harmonica he had requested before blastoff, which he had used to pass away the long hours in Inverspace. "No idea. How long have you been at war with the Delgartes? Don't you even know who your planet's at war with?" "I've been rural for many years, but aren't they always at war with someone?" The ensign looked startled. "Not unless it's to protect the peace of the galaxies. Earth is a peace-loving—" Gunderson cut him off. "Yes, I know. But how long have you been at war with the Delgartes? I thought they were our allies under some treaty, pact, or other." The spaceman's face contorted in a picture of conditioned hatred. "We've been after the bastards since they jumped one of our mining planets outside their cluster." He twisted his lips in open loathing. "We'll clean the bastards out soon enough. Teach them to jump, peaceful Earthmen." Gunderson wished he could shut out the words. He had heard the same story all the way from A Centauri 9 and back. Someone had always jumped someone else. Someone was always at war with someone else. There were always bastards to be cleaned out. Never any peace. Never any peace. The Invership whipped past the myriad odd colors of Inverspace, hurtling through that not space toward the alien duster. Gunderson sat in the teleport-proof stateroom, triple-coated Loctite, and waited. He had no idea what they wanted of him, why they had tested him, why they had sent him through the pre-flight checkups, why he was in not space. But he knew one thing. Whatever it was, there was to be no peace for him, ever. He silently cursed the strange mental power he had, the power to make the molecules of anything speed up tremendously, making them grind against one another, causing combustion. A strange, channeled teleport faculty that was useless for anything but the creation of fire. He damned it soulfully, wishing he had been born deaf, mute, blind, incapable of having to ward off the world. From the first moment of his life when he had realized his strange power, he had been haunted. No control, no identification, no communication. Cut off, tagged as an Audi. Not even the pleasures of being an acknowledged Psioid like the Mindies, or the invaluable Drivers, or the Blasters, or the Malaports, who could move the atoms of flesh to their design. He was an Audi, a strange breed, and worse, he was a non-directive Psioid, tagged, deadly, and uncontrollable. He could set the fires, but he couldn't control them. The molecules were too tiny, too quickly imitative for him to stop the activity once it was started. It had to stop of its own volition, and occasionally, it was too long in stopping. Once, he had thought himself normal. Once, he had thought of leading an ordinary life, of perhaps becoming a musician. But that idea had died aflaming, as all other normal ideas that had followed it. First, the ostracism. Then the hunting, then the arrests and the prison terms, one after another. Now something new, something he could not understand. What did they want with him? It was obviously in connection with the mighty battle being fought between Earth and the Delgarts, but of what use could his unreliable powers be? Why was he in this most marvelous of the new spacecom ships, heading toward the central sun of the enemy cluster, and why should he help Earth in any case? At that moment, the locks popped, the safe broke open, and the clanging of the alarms was heard to the bowels of the Invership. The ensign stopped him as he started to rise, started toward the safe. The ensign thumbed a button on his wrist console. "Hold it, Mr. Gunderson. I wasn't told what was in there, but I was told to keep you away from it until the other two got here." Gunderson slumped back, hopelessly, on the acceleration bunk. He dropped the harmonica to the metal floor and lowered his head into his hands. "What other two?" "I don't know, sir. I wasn't told." The other two were Psioids, naturally. When the Mindy and the Blaster arrived, they motioned the ensign to remove the contents of the safe. He walked over nervously, took out the tiny recorder and the single speak tip. "Play it, ensign," the Mindy directed. The spaceman thumbed the speak tip into the hole, and the grating of the blank space at the beginning of the tip filled the room. "You can leave now, ensign," the Mindy said. After the spacecom officer had securely loctited the door, the voice began. Gunderson recognized it immediately as that of Terrence, head of Spacecom, the man who had questioned him tirelessly at the Bureau building in Buenos Aires. Terrence, hero of another war, the Earth-Kyban War, now head of Spacecom. The words were brittle, almost without inflection, and to the point, yet they carried a sense of utmost importance. "Gunderson," it began, "we have, as you already know, a job for you. By this time, the ship will have reached central point of your trip through Inverspace. You will arrive in 2 days Earth time at a slip-out point approximately 500 million miles from Omalo, the enemy's sun. You will be far behind enemy lines, but we are certain you will be able to accomplish your mission safely. That is why you have been given this new ship. It can withstand anything the enemy can throw. But we want you to get back for other reasons. You are the most important man in our war effort, Gunderson, and it's tied up with your mission. We want you to turn the sun Omalo into a supernova." Gunderson, for the first time in 38 years of bleak, gray life, was staggered. The very concept made his stomach churn. Turn another people's sun into a flaming, gaseous bomb of incalculable power, spreading death into space, burning off the very layers of its being, charring into nothing the planets of the system? Annihilate, in one move, an entire culture? Was it possible they thought him mad? What did they think he was capable of? Could he direct his mind to such a task? Could he do it? Should he do it? His mind boggled at the possibility. He had never really considered himself as having many ideals. He had set fires in warehouses to get the owners their liability insurance. He had flamed other hobos who had tried to rob him. He had used the unpredictable power of his mind for many things, but this was the murder of a solar system. He wasn't in any way sure he could turn a sun supernova. What was there to lead them to think he might be able to do it? Burning a forest and burning a giant red sun were two things fantastically far apart. It was something out of a nightmare, but even if he could. "In case you find the task unpleasant, Mr. Gunderson," the ice-chipped voice of the Spacecom head continued, "we have included in this ship's complement a Mindy and a blaster. Their sole job is to watch and protect you, Mr. Gunderson, to make certain you are kept in the proper, patriotic state of mind. They have been instructed to read you from this moment on, and should you not be willing to carry out your assignment, well, I'm certain you are familiar with the blaster's capabilities." Gunderson stared at the blank-faced telepath sitting across from him on the other bunk. The man was obviously listening to every thought in Gunderson's head. A strange, nervous expression was on the Mindy's face. His gaze turned to the blaster who accompanied him, then back to Gunderson. The pyrotic swiveled a glance at the blaster, then swiveled away as quickly. Blasters were men meant to do one job only, and a certain type of man he became, he had to be successful doing that job. They all looked the same, and Gunderson found the look almost terrifying. He had not thought he could be terrified anymore. "That is your assignment, Gunderson, and if you have any hesitance, remember they are not human. They are extraterrestrials as unlike you as you are unlike a slug. And remember, there's a war on. You will be saving the lives of many Earthmen by performing this task. This is your chance to become respected, Gunderson. A hero, respected, and for the first time," he paused as though not wishing to say what was next, "for the first time, worthy of your world." The rasp, rasp, rasp of the silent record filled the stateroom. Gunderson said nothing. He could hear the phrase whirling, whirling in his head. "There's a war on. There's a war on. There's a war on. There's a war on." He stood up and slowly walked to the door. "Sorry, Mr. Gunderson," the Mindee said emphatically. "We can't allow you to leave this room." He sat down and lifted the battered mouth organ from where it had fallen. He fingered it for a while, then put it to his lips. He blew, but made no sound, and he didn't leave. They thought he was asleep. The Mindy, a cadaverously thin man with hair grayed at the temples and slicked back in strips on top, with a gasping speech and a nervous movement of hand to ear, spoke to the blaster.
"He doesn't seem to be thinking, John."
The blaster's smooth, hard features moved vaguely in the nearest thing to an expression, and a quirking frown split his ink-lined mouth. "Can he do it?" The Mindy rose, ran a hand quickly through the straight, slicked hair.
"Can he do it? No, he shouldn't be able to do it, but he's doing it. I can't figure it out. It's eerie, uncanny. Either I've lost it, or he's got something new."
"Trauma barrier?"
"That's what they told me before I left, that he seemed to be blocked off, but they thought it was only temporary. Once he was away from the bureau buildings, he would clear up." "But he isn't cleared up."
The blaster looked concerned. "Maybe it's you."
"I didn't get a master's rating for nothing, John. And I tell you, there isn't a trauma barrier I can't at least get something through. If only a snatch of gabble, but there's nothing. Nothing."
"Maybe it's you," the blaster repeated, still concerned.
"Damn it, it's not me. I can read you, can't I? Your right foot hurts from new boots. You wish you could have the bunk to lie down on. You, oh, hell, I can read you, and I can read the captain up front, and I can read the pitman in the hold, but I can't read him. It's like hitting a sheet of glass in his head. There should be a reflection or some penetration, but it seems to be opaqued. I didn't want to say anything when he was awake, of course."
"Do you think I should twit him a little? Wake him up and warn him we're on to his game?"
The Mindy raised a hand to stop the very thought of the blaster. Great gods, no!
He gestured wildly.
This Gunderson's invaluable. If they found out we'd done anything unauthorized to him, we'd both be tanked.
Gunderson lay on his acceleration bunk, feigning sleep, listening to them. It was a new discovery to him, what they were saying. He had always suspected the pyrotic faculty of his mind. It was just too unstable to be a true-bred trait. There had to be side effects, other differences from the norm. He knew he could not read minds. Was this now another factor? Impenetrability by mindies? He wondered. Perhaps the blaster was powerless too. It would never clear away his problem. That was something he could do only in his own mind, but it might make his position and final decision safer. There was only one way to find out. He knew the blaster could not actually harm him severely by Spacecom's orders, but he wouldn't hesitate blasting off one of the pyrotic's arms, cauterizing it as it disappeared, to warn him if the situation seemed desperate enough. The blaster had seemed to Gunderson a singularly overzealous man in any case. It was a terrible risk, but he had to know. There was only one way to find out, and he took it, finding a startling new vitality in himself, for the first time in over 30 years. He snapped his legs off the bunk and lunged across the stateroom, shouldering aside the mindy and straight-arming the blaster in the mouth. The blaster, surprised by the rapid and completely unexpected movement, had a reflex thought, and one entire bulkhead was washed by bolts of power. They crackled, and the plasteel buckled. His direction had been upset, had been poor, but Gunderson knew the instant he regained his mental balance, the power would be directed at him. The bulkhead oxidized and popped as it was broken, revealing the outer insulating hull of the inverse ship. Rivets snapped out of their holes and clattered to the floor. Gunderson was at the stateroom door, palming the Loctite open, having watched the manner used by the blaster when he had left on several occasions, and putting one foot into the companionway. Then the blaster struck. His fury rose, and he lost his sense of duty. This man had struck him. He was a psioid, an accepted psioid, not an oddy. His eyes deepened, their black immeasurably, and his face strained, his cheekbones rose in a stricture of grin, and the force materialized. All around Gunderson. He could feel the heat. He could see his clothes sparking and disappearing. He could feel his hair charring at the tips. He could feel the strain of psi power in the air. But there was no effect on him. He was safe. Safe from the power of the blasters. Then he knew he didn't have to run. He turned back to the cabin. The two psioids were staring at him in open terror. It was always night in Inverspace. The ship constantly plowed through a swamp of black, with metal inside and metal outside, and the cold, unchanging devil dark beyond the metal. Men hated Inverspace. They sometimes took the years-long journey through normal space to avoid the chilling life of Inverspace. For one moment, the total black would surround the ship, and the next, they would be sifting through a field of changing, flickering, crazy quilt colors. Then, ebony again. Then light. Then dots. Then shafts, then the dark once more. It was ever-changing, like a madman's dream, but not interestingly changing, so one would wish to watch as one might watch a kaleidoscope. This was strange and unnatural, something beyond the powers of the mind or the abilities of the eye to comprehend. Ports were allowed only in officers' country, and those had solid lead shields that would slam down and dog closed at the slap of a button. Nothing could be done. Men were only men, and space was their eternal enemy. But no man willingly stared back at the deep of Inverspace. In officers' country, Alf Gunderson reached with his sight and his mind into the coal soot
that now lay beyond the ship. Since he had proved his invulnerability over the blaster, he had been given the run of the ship. Where could he go? Nowhere that he could not be found. Guards watched the egress ports at all times, so he was still, in effect, a prisoner on the Inver ship. He had managed to secure time alone, however, and so with the captain and his officers locked out of country, he stood alone, watching. He stared. The giant quartz window, all shields open, all the darkness flowing in. The cabin was dark, but not half so dark as that darkness that was everywhere. The darkness deeper than the darkness. What was he? Was he man, or was he machine, to be told he must turn a sun nova? What of the people on that sun's planets? What of the women and the children, alien or not? What of the people who hated war, and the people who served because they had been told to serve, and the people who wanted to be left alone? What of the men who went into the fields while their fellow troops dutifully sharpened their war knives and cried? Cried because they were afraid, and they were tired, and they wanted home without death. What of those men? Was this war one of salvation, or liberation, or duty, as they parroted the phrases of patriotism? Or was this still another of the unending wars for domination, larger holdings, richer worlds? Was this another dupe of the universe, where men were sent to their deaths so one type of government, no better than another, could rule? He didn't know. He wasn't sure. He was afraid. He had a power beyond all powers in his hands, and he suddenly found himself not a tramp and a waste, but a man who could demolish a solar system at his own will. Not even sure he could do it, he considered the possibility, and it terrified him. Making his legs turn to ice water, his blood to steam, he was suddenly quite lost, and immersed into a deeper darkness than he had ever known, with no way out. He spoke to himself, letting his words sound foolish to himself, but sounding them just the same, knowing he had avoided sounding them for much too long. Can I do it? Should I? I've waited so long to find a place. Now they tell me I've found a place. Is this my final place? Is this what I've lived and searched for? I can be a valuable war weapon. I can be the man the men turn to when they want a job done, but what sort of job? Can I do it? Is it more important to me to find peace, even a peace such as this, and to destroy, than to go on with the unrest? Alf Gunderson stared at the night, at the faint tinges of color beginning to form at the edges of his vision, and his mind washed itself in the water of thought. He had discovered much about himself in the past few days. He had discovered many talents, many ideals he had never suspected in himself. He had discovered he had character, and that he was not a hopeless, oddy hulk doomed to die wasted. He found he had a future, if he could make the proper decision. But what was the proper decision?
Omalo! Omalo, snap out!
The cry roared through the companionways, bounced down the halls and against the metal hull of the Inver ship, sprayed from the speakers, and deafened the men asleep beside their squawk boxes. The ship plowed through a maze of colors whose hues were unknown, skittered scudwise, and popped out, shuddering. There it was. The son of Delgart, Omalo. Big and golden, with planets set about like boulders on the edge of the sea that was space and from which this ship had come, with death in its hold, and death in its tubes, and death, nothing but death. The blaster and the Mindy escorted Alf Gunderson to the bridge. They stood back and let him walk to the huge quartz portal. The portal before which the Pyrotic had stood so long, so many hours, gazing so deep into Inver space. They left him there,
and stood back because they knew he was safe from them. No matter how hard they held his arms, no matter how fiercely they shouted at him, he was safe. He was something new, not just a pyrotic, not just a mind-blocked, not just a blaster safe. He was something totally new, not a composite, for there had been many of those with imperfect powers of several psi types, but something new and something incomprehensible. Psioid plus, with a plus that might mean anything. Gunderson moved forward slowly, his deep shadow squirming out before him, sliding up the console, across the portal shelf, and across the quartz itself. Himself superimposed across the immensity of space. The man who was Gunderson stared into the night that lay without, and at the sun that burned steadily and high in that night. A greater fire raged within him than on that molten surface. His was a power he could not even begin to estimate, and if he let it be used in this way, this once, it could be turned to this purpose over and over and over again. Was there any salvation for him?
"You're supposed to flame that sun, Gunderson," the slick-haired Mindy said, trying to assume an authoritative tone, a tone of command, but failing miserably. He knew he was powerless before this man. They could shoot him, of course, but what would that accomplish?
"What are you going to do, Gunderson? What do you have in mind?" the blaster chimed in. "Spacecom wants Omalo fired. Are you going to do it, or do we have to report you as a traitor? You know what they'll do to you back on Earth, Gunderson. You know, don't you?"
Alf Gunderson let the light of Omalo wash his sunken face with red haze. His eyes seemed to deepen in intensity. His hands on the console ledge stiffened, and the knuckles turned white. He had seen the possibilities, and he had decided. They would never understand that he had chosen the harder way. He turned slowly. "Where's the life scoot located?" They stared at him, and he repeated his question. They refused to answer, and he shouldered past them, stepped into the drop tube to take him below decks. The Mindies spun on him, his face raging.
"You're a coward and a traitor, Fireboy. You're a lousy, no-psi freak, and we'll get you. You can take the lifeboat, but someday we'll find you. No matter where you go out there, we're going to find you."
He spat then, and the blaster strained and strained and strained, but the power of his mind had no effect on Gunderson. The pyrotic let the drop shaft lower him, and he found the life scoot some time later. He took nothing with him but the battered harmonica and the red flush of Omalo on his face. When they felt the pop of the life scoot being snapped into space, and they saw the dark gray dot of it moving rapidly away, flicking quickly off into inverspace, the blaster and the Mindy slumped into relaxers, stared at each other. "We'll have to finish the war without him." The blaster nodded. "Could have won it for us in 1 minute. He's gone."
"Do you think he could have done it?"
The blaster shrugged his heavy shoulders.
"I just don't know. Perhaps."
"He's gone," the Mindy repeated bitterly. "He's gone, coward, traitor. Someday.
"Where can he go?"
"He's a wanderer at heart. Space is deep. He can go anywhere."
"Do you mean that, about finding him someday?"
The Mindy nodded rapidly.
"When they find out, back on Earth, what he did today, they'll start hunting him through all of space. He'll never have another moment's peace. They have to find him. He's the perfect weapon, but he can't run forever. They'll find him."
"A strange man.
A man with a power he can't hide, John. A man who will sooner or later give himself away. He can't hide himself cleverly enough to stay hidden forever."
"Odd that he would turn himself into a fugitive. Could have had peace of mind for the rest of his life. Instead, he's got this."
The Mindy stared at the closed portal shields. His tones were bitter and frustrated.
"We'll find him someday."
The ship shuddered, reversed drives, and slipped back into Inverspace.
Much Sky winked back at him. He sat on the bluff, wind tousling his gray hair, flapping softly at the dirty shirt tail hanging from his pants top. The minstrel sat on the bluff, watching the land fall slopingly away under him, down to the shining hide of the sprawling dragon lying in the cup of the hills. The dragon slept, awake, across once lush grass and productive ground. City. On this far world, far from a red sun that shone high and steady, the minstrel sat and pondered the many kinds of peace, and the kind that is not peace can never be peace. His eyes turned once more to the sage and eternal advice of the blackness above. No one saw him wink back at the silent stars, deeper than the darkness. With a sigh, he slung the battered theremin over his frayed shoulders. It was a portable machine with both rods bent and its power pack patched and soldered. His body almost at once assumed the half-slouch, round-shouldered walk of the wanderer. He ambled down the hill toward the rocket field. They called it the rocket field out here on the edge, but they didn't use rockets any longer. Now they rode to space on a whistling tube that glimmered and sparkled behind itself like a small animal chuckling over a private joke. The joke was that the little animal knew the riders were never coming back. It whistled and sparkled till it flicked off into some crazy quilt knot space and was gone forever. Tarmac clicked under the heels of his boots. Bright, shining boots, kept meticulously clean by polishing over polishing till they reflected back the corona of the field cleagues, and even more faintly, the gleam of the night. The minstrel kept them cleaned and polished, a clashing note matched against his generally unkempt appearance. He was tall, towering over almost everyone he had ever met in his homeless wanderings. His body was a lean and supple thing, like a high-tension wire, the merest suggestion of contained power and quickness. The man moved with an easy gait, accentuating his long legs and gangling arms, making his well-proportioned head seem a bubble precariously balanced on a neck too long and thin to support it. He kept time to the click of the polished boots with a soft half-hum, half-whistle. The song was a dead song, long forgotten. He, too, was a half-dead, half-forgotten thing. He came from beyond the mountains. No one knew where. No one cared where. He had almost forgotten. But they listened when he came. They listened almost reverently, having heard the stories about him with a desperation born of men who know they are severed from their home worlds, who know they will go out and out and seldom come back. He sang of space, and he sang of land, and he sang of the nothing that is left for man. All men, no matter how many arms they have or what their skin is colored, when he has expended the last little bit of eternity to which he is entitled. His voice had the sadness of death in it, the sadness of death before life has finished its work. But it had the joy of metal under quick fingers, the strength of turned nickel steel, and the whip of heart and soul working through loneliness. They listened when his song came with the night wind, probing, crying, lonely through the darkness of a thousand worlds and in a thousand worlds. The pitmen stopped their work as he came, silent but for the hum of his song and the beat of his boots on the blacktop. They watched as he came across the field. There was no doubt who it was. He had been wandering the star paths for many years now. He had appeared, and that was all. He was. They knew him as certainly as they knew themselves. They turned, and he was like a pillar set dark against the light and shadow of the field. He paced slowly, and they stopped the hoses feeding the radioactive food to the little animals, and stopped the torches they boiled on the metal skins. And they listened.
The minstrel knew they were listening, and he unslung his instrument, settling the narrow box with its tone rods around his neck by its thong. As his fingers cajoled and pleaded and extracted the song of a soul cast into the pit of the void, left to die, crying in torment not so much at death, but at the terror of being alone when the last calling came. And the workmen cried. They felt no shame as the tears coursed through the dirt on their faces and over the sweat shine left from toil. They stood, silent in all feeling as he came toward them. Then, with many small crescendos and before they even knew it was ended, and for seconds after the wail had fled back across the field into the mountains, they listened to the last notes of his lament. Hands wiped clumsily across faces, leaving more dirt than before, and backs turned slowly as men resumed work. It seemed they could not face him the nearer he came, as though he was too deep-seeing, too perceptive for them to be at ease close by. It was a mixture of respect and awe. The minstrel stood, waiting.
"Hey, you!"
The minstrel stood, waiting, the pad of soft-soled feet behind him. A spaceman, tanned, supple, almost as tall as the ballad singer, reminding the ballad singer of another spaceman, a blonde-haired boy he had known long ago, came up behind the silent figure. The minstrel had not moved.
"What can I do for you, minstrel?"
asked the spaceman, tones of the south of a long, faraway continent rich in his voice.
"What do they call this world?" the minstrel asked.
The voice was quiet, like a needle being drawn through velvet. He spoke in a hushed monotone, yet his voice was clear and bore traces of an uncountable number of accents.
"The natives call it Audi, and the charts call it Rexa Majoris 29, minstrel. Why?"
"It's time to move on."
The southerner grinned hugely, lines of amusement crinkling out over his watery brown eyes.
"Need a lift?"
The minstrel nodded, smiling back enigmatically. The spaceman's face softened, the lines of squinting into the reaches of an eternal night broke, and he extended his hands.
"My name's Quantry, top dog on the Spirit of Lucy Marlowe. If you don't mind working your keep off by singing for the passengers, we'd be pleased to have you on board."
The tall man smiled, a quick radiance across the darkness the shadows made of his face.
"That isn't work."
"Then done," exclaimed the spaceman. "Come on, I'll fix you a bunk and steerage."
They walked between the wiper gangs and the pitmen. They threaded their way between the glare of fluoro torches and the sputtering blast of robot welding instruments. The man named Quantry indicated the opening in the smooth side of the ship, and the minstrel clambered inside. Quantry fixed the berth just behind the reactor feeder bins, sealing off the compartment with an electrical blanket draped over a loading track bar. The minstrel lay on his bunk, a repair bench, with a pillow under his head. He lay, thinking. The moments fled silently, and his mind, deep in thought, hardly realized the ports were being dogged home. The radioactive additives were being sluiced through their tubes to the reactors. The blast tubes were being extruded. His mind did not leave in its thoughts as the atomic motors warmed, turning the pit to green glass beneath the ship's bulk. Motors that would carry the ship to a height where the driver would be wakened from his sleep or her sleep, as was more often the case with that particular breed of psioid, to snap the ship through into inverspace. As the ship came unstuck from solid ground, hurled itself outward on an unquenchable tail of fire, the minstrel lay back, letting the reassuring hand of acceleration press him into deeper reverie. Thoughts spun of the past, of the further past, and of all the pasts he had known.
Then the reactors cut off, the ship shuddered, and he knew they were in Inverspace. The minstrel sat up, his eyes far away, his thoughts deep inside the cloud cover of a world billions of light years away, hundreds of years lost to him. A world he would never see again. There was a time for running, and a time for resting. And even in the running, there could be resting. He smiled to himself so faintly, it was not a smile. Down in the reactor rooms, they heard his song. They heard the build to it, matching, sustaining, whining in tune with the Inverspace drive. They grinned at each other with a sweet sadness their faces were never expected to wear. "It's gonna be a good trip," said one to another. In officer's country, Quantry looked up at the tight slammed shields blocking off the patchwork insanity of Knot Space, and he smiled. It was going to be a good trip. In the saloons, the passengers listened to the odd strains of lonely music coming up from below, and even they were forced to admit, though they had no way of explaining how they knew, that this was indeed going to be a good trip. And in steerage, his fingers wandering across the keyboard of the battered theremin, no one noticed that the man they called the minstrel had lit his cigarette without a match.